The Unpublished Podcast with Amy and James.
Hello, creatives. Welcome to another episode of the Unpublished Podcast. My name is Amy.
I'm James.
And today we have a really special guest, round two. Seth Haddon is on the pod. I'm so excited to dive into this conversation about your new book, about submissions, about working with publishers, about writing on the, just all of it.
And also special mention as well. I think Seth is our first repeat guest.
So
place of honor. I think that's true.
Yeah.
So welcome, Seth.
Thank you. Loved me so much the first time. Thank you for having me.
So book two has just come out 2 days ago, 3 days ago.
Yeah, 2 days ago. Officially. 2 days ago. Well, in Australia, at least.
Right.
The 24th. So I think that's
yes, of course, of course. For your American viewers, I think, you know, I know some of you can find time zones difficult in America.
I know.
I'm so sorry. We love you. Love you a lot. How's the launch been?
It's been really, really good. I was quite nervous because, so for anyone who doesn't know, Reborn is not exactly a sequel, but it's almost a companion book. Like, it takes place in the same world as my first book, Reforged. And a side character from Reforged is the love interest in Reborn. So there's a bit of a through line, but it is technically a standalone. So I had all these worries about, I guess, having an audience crossover come through, and also that, the general fear of any sort of creative perfectionist that your first work is a fluke and you're actually an imposter. And
that's huge. Of course that comes up. It's amazing, no matter where we are in the journey, like, we'll always find some sort of story that says, no, actually this time it can't possibly work.
I was reading Terry Pratchett's autobiography the other day, and apparently biography, and apparently every time he'd have his final conversation with his editor online, he'd hang up the phone and say to his assistant, "We got away with it again."
I mean, it's both relieving and horrifying that it's going to stay with you, even if you're as incredible as Terry Pratchett. Yeah, validating and horrifying.
That's why we've got to do the work.
Yeah,
and I think for me, because I had an in-person launch for Reborn, the same as I had for Reforged, and I had fewer people show up, and I was like, oh God, you know, like, it's going to translate into fewer sales. But I show up at the bookstore, and they're like, actually, we have 45 pre-orders from complete strangers. I was like, oh, okay. So it ended up being the exact same amount of books sold as my debut at the launch, at the physical launch, which was
great.
Validating.
Very validating.
And also the worry is as well, if it's a sequel, I know you're saying it's a soft sequel, but if it's a sequel, some people will go, oh, you know, I haven't read book one.
Fall off.
Were these discussions that you had with your publisher about, you know, how much of a hard sequel do we want to make it, and whether that will affect sales, etc.?
Yes. I think as well, because Reforge was such a strange project. I'll just give a quick recap for anyone who's new. Reforge wasn't a book that I completed and then pitched to a publisher. It was that I'd written a completely different novel, which had been rejected, and then a small press offered me a mentorship. And Reforge was initially meant to be a 20,000 word novella, which I failed incredibly hard and wrote a 100,000 word book instead. And so I guess initially when I got round to that deal, it became a 3-book deal. And at first I thought I would be writing three books with the same characters all the way through. And I got to the end of Reforged and had a happily ever after, and thought, well, not only do I have to create external conflict, and the external conflict sort of came easily. It's a king story, right? There's a kingdom and an empire, and just based on history, these things are never stable. So I was like, that's very easy to create. But the internal conflict in the relationship I'd have to generate, and I'm like, oh, but that just got settled. I really didn't want to do it.
Yeah, so, I respect that.
Yeah, and it was difficult because I was like, oh, I had this image that it would be a trilogy with the same characters. So trying to figure out what the story would be became difficult, and also talking to my publisher. I mean, on one hand, it was like it's almost like a soft introduction to writing a sequel, because sequels are notoriously difficult to write. So it's like you're kind of carrying the story on, but you have a new characters and potentially a new setting within the same world. So it's a, like, it's like baby's first sequel.
I love that.
It's like an easy way.
But you have the structure of the world building there, right? Which is nice. It's just you're moving to your geography. So it's a new kingdom, an area in the same world, which is really cool.
Yeah.
I really like that.
This book has a map, which you can see. Listeners can see. But book one takes place in this tiny peninsula, and then book two is an empire. So it's a much larger stage.
Yeah.
There's a lot more like where you can go and what you can do with that. But yeah, I guess in terms of sales, I'm not entirely sure if we ever had a conversation beyond like trying to assuage my anxiety, you know. Because I just continued social media and TikTok, which is such a big source of my fan base, is TikTok.
So cool.
You're so good. Amy and I have tried, especially for Amy's recent self-pub, and I think, you know, it's done really well for Amy, but the Instagram, you can't do the same thing with Instagram Reels, I think, as TikTok. And then we're just too, we're only 5 years older than you, but we already feel like we're...
That's not what I believe.
Okay, I agree. But I do just feel like I don't believe this is something that's set in stone, but I just feel like you're better than us at TikTok.
James, no, I resent this completely.
What do you have to say about that?
Well, I just think that I speak to so many people who completely, they say, no, TikTok's not for me. I'm too old and I won't buy it. I haven't figured out TikTok yet, and that's okay. I also already have a very, you know, a big and really functioning social media platform on Instagram, and it's hard, you know, I mean, I'm guessing you might find it similar. Like, all your energy goes to where you get the interaction. And so trying to build other platforms, you know, they don't get as much of your time. They don't get as much of, you don't get dopamine hits from them. So they're less appealing.
I think the idea that, I mean, I think it is true now that authors also have to be able to market themselves or to have a brand that's saleable, especially in TradPub. Being able to have yourself sellable as a brand is really important. I have agent siblings. I've actually been talking to James about, who have had or are in discussions with big publishing houses, and the fact that they do not have a big social media following is now becoming really significant. But I mean, I really can only do TikTok and Instagram, and then occasionally like phase into Twitter and be like, hello, and then I have to go back and fade out. Like,
I mean, I haven't checked your TikTok numbers recently, Seth, but my understanding is that you started from zero and essentially just like, you know, it's not like you have millions and millions of followers on TikTok. It's like you just have, you're good at communicating with the people you need to communicate with. Like, you don't need to have hundreds of thousands of followers. It's just like you need to be able to connect with the audience that you want to connect with and be able to show evidence that you do that.
I've got 49,000 followers on my main TikTok account.
Amazing.
Yes.
On a personal project one, I have about 3,000. But okay, cool. I still get very viral number, like 40,000 views, 60,000 views, 100 and something thousand views. And occasionally you'll get like 200, 500, whatever. And one of them will pick up. But even with 49,000 followers on TikTok, the thing about TikTok that I find that's very different to something like Instagram is that it's a lot easier to gather followers, but that doesn't mean that your content is being shown to 49,000 people, because it keeps, like, the algorithm on TikTok shows your content to new people, which is why it's easier to gather and to grow. But that doesn't mean that your engagement rates are going to be particularly good. Like, I remember having a very viral TikTok a few months ago when I just announced the pre-order of Reborn. It was 460,000 views or whatever, and my publisher emails me like, oh my god, did you just have a viral TikTok, because we just got all these books. I was like, oh, I'm sitting here thinking, oh, all these books have been sold. She's like, we got 23 orders. I was like, oh, 23. That conversion rate is not great, you know, for 460,000 views. But
yes,
I guess that just shows the number. the numbers we're working with in publishing, right? It's like, you know, that is still a decent number of pre-orders for a book. Like, it's
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
It's not, and that's the thing.
In like, one day, like, that was like, wow, 23 yeah. orders in one day.
And I guess like, it's like, oh, if you can bring, if you are someone who can bring, you know, a few viral TikToks or a few viral reels to your book, it's like, then you're still, that's going to be more than someone who can bring zero.
Yeah.
And, and that's insane. Like, once again, I don't want to have this narrative that you have to have a million followers on social media to get published. But obviously it's like, but if you can show them that you're capable of yeah. marketing yourself.
I think it's the brand, especially yeah. like being able to say, not even like I'm the guy that writes gay political fantasy or whatever, but being able to say I have fans, I have people yeah. that engage with me, and I have conversations. I have people that flew from Perth for my
That's
book
so
launch
cool.
down from Brisbane, up from I can't remember where, but like people who I've never met in person.
Seth, that's amazing.
Know. And the amazing thing is it's only been when did Reforged come out?
October last year, so it's been,
so it's literally a year in a year.
I
it's
am
so
like
cool.
Very about this.
And someone got a forearm tattoo.
No,
amazing.
You got your first tattoo.
I got my first tattoo. A full Gedrock tattoo, which are the creatures in my book.
Stop.
And it's like, what?
That's so cool.
Yeah, but it's like they're the people that you really
hold and tight
connecting with. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So.
There's that famous essay called 1,000 True Fans, and you know, which essentially suggests that if you can get 1,000 people who just really believe in you, that's enough. That's enough.
That is enough.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah.
And I think that means, you know, 1,000 true fans doesn't look like 1,000 followers on Instagram, because it needs to be a bit more. It needs to be those real, like committed creators.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean 100,000. It doesn't, you know, it just means, yeah, you need to find your people. I have a question about whether you enjoy creating your brand, whether you enjoy creating this content, because something we hear from a lot of different types of creators, but from authors in particular, is they resent the fact that this is a part of the job now. And I wonder what your relationship with it is.
I think it's a bit mixed. I mean, I think at first I resented it because I'm not particularly extroverted. And I was like, oh, I'm going to have to put on this persona and then it's going to be all this energy. But I guess in my first year, I was doing a lot more like costumes. I was dressing up as my characters and doing things like that, which I've grown tired of now.
Yeah, yeah.
I used to be a cosplayer, and so I was like, oh yeah, like this reminds me of all that. And now, I mean, the content that it is content that you're generating. It's very different to the art of writing. It's a completely separate thing. But I'm finding I like the entire business side of writing as well. So I'm really enjoying it. But it's also not a huge time commitment if you know what you're trying to sell. And sometimes all you really have to do is find a trope. Tropes are very easy to sell on TikTok. Like Reborn is a very complicated book to sell. I found this a lot more difficult than Reforged, where I could just be like King and Paladin and they kiss, you know?
Yeah.
This one involves a kind of vain merchant lord and a guy who's effectively a prophet. Like, it doesn't have the same ring to it.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it's very difficult to boil it
there
down.
You go. Then again, like vain merchant lord, I'm seeing
I'm there immediately. Gray.
I'm seeing like I'm, you know, I feel like there's that kind of, you know, in the modern sense, it would be the CEO or something, or the like
yeah.
that kind of relationship. Although obviously with the prophet, maybe it's a slightly different dynamic, but you could lean into that.
But like the tropes would then be something like grumpy ex sunshine, which is a very trope heavy thing, or more fan fiction based stuff like accidental marriage. And that's something I found where this is one scene and they have accidentally get married because they're from foreign countries. And, you know, it's very tropey. It happens like at least a third of the way through the book. It's not a core.
Yeah, but lean
more
in.
Fan service-y. But this is what I made one TikTok. It went viral, and almost every time I've reused that trope, the videos have gone off. So then it becomes like, okay, how can I milk this to death and reach new audiences? And it becomes like a 15-second TikTok. You do 5, 5, 5, whatever the scene is, and then they accidentally get married. Or you can just do two things and do 4 seconds, 4 seconds, and have two things, and usually the videos that I put the least amount of effort in do.
Oh my god, what is that? What is that?
It's when you're panicking, you're like, oh god, I haven't done anything in 3 days, and you're like, I'm gonna film something, and that's the one. Anything that you plan, you put effort into, it's not happening. You get 200
shit. Views. Don't try. That's the message of this podcast. Yeah, yeah. Don't try. I love that, and for us as well, like, I'm so in love with that kind of the business and the art of business as well behind you know, what it is to write books. So I love having these discussions, because I think it can be so much fun, and I think, as you said, there are ways to figure it out so that it's not time sucking and it's not taking over your writing process. I mean, you've had an incredibly abundant year of writing. Like, your word count this year is insane, and you've also managed to, you know, create and continue to build your brand.
Yeah, maybe we could transition quickly into talking about how you have been managing, you know, writing so much and also working at the same time, and how you know, how your work situation might have changed in the last year or so, and working on, you know, I'll do the sub questions later, but we could start with that.
Yeah, I actually have a spreadsheet that I've been keeping track of my word count for this year, because
oh my god, I love.
And sorry, Amy, I have a bit of background here, because, you know, I think what people don't realize is that even though you have three books under, well, you have now one more book under contract, you still have to work on your own projects at the same time, because, you know, after that contract ends, it's like, well, you want to have something that you can still put out
to
there,
move
right?
on to. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I copied this from Alexandra Roland, who wrote A Taste of Iron and Gold, Gold and Iron, brother, which is a book following the kind of king ex knight trope. And it just happened to come out like a month or two before Reforged. So it was like, oh, how crazy. And they had this spreadsheet, and that was kind of what I'd followed. So I had 1, 2, 3, 4, about 5 separate projects this year. Now 6, actually, now that I'm... Oh no, 5. Yeah, 5 different projects this year. That are, yeah, personal contracted books and hopefully future projects. So it's about 200,000 all up, including like a 20,000 word edit of Reborn at the beginning of the year.
Yeah,
publishing. And I guess what happened between, like, last year I was working 5 days a week, and I found, even when I quit that job, I had about a 2 month break, and I just didn't have any structure, and I was like, well, I'm writing practically the same amount as I was
when you were
when
working.
I was working full time.
So often the case.
Yeah. And then I transitioned to a contract job where I'm also writing. I'm writing for video games, which was my initial degree. So I'm a narrative designer for a Melbourne studio, and I work 3 days a week there on a psychological thriller game, and then I write everything else. So my contracted book takes priority, and I had a really different process with that this year, where I was mostly doing scene blocking and trying to, because it's a fantasy mystery, and I've never written in that genre, so I was writing scene blocking and dialogue and not barely any prose. And then I wrote a novella in March and April, which I then went on submission with, and then 2 personal projects, which are about 60,000 words
each,
all up.
All
and, oh no, like, no, it's combined is what I've yeah, okay.
And, yeah. Your output, because for those of you who haven't listened to the first episode, Seth and I were met in a writing group. And my memory is that you didn't have this big an output back then, did you? Like, I feel like this has been a real level up. And I wonder if you could, if you had any ideas about, was it like getting your first contract kind of spurred you on, and then you could get the dopamine hits of knowing that, you know, your work was out there? or do you have any ideas as to like how you managed to increase your output like this?
I think 2 things. The first thing is that during that year when we did the course, the book I was writing is the one that got rejected a bunch of times and eventually led me to the mentorship. But I also remember being very stubborn about that book being my debut. Because I remember being in a car with the teacher of that, and she straight up told me that this book was not going to be the book that got me published, but that I would get published. And I was like, how? dare you? Like, this book, I've been working on this book for like 4 years, and you know, you're so in it, you're like, no, this is going to be my debut, this is the one I want in the world first. And I was so attached to it, and then sort of having to admit that it's okay, perhaps it's not as good as I think, or perhaps working on it for 4 years has been the learning curve, and now I can start fresh with the skills that I've developed from this and come back to it at a later date, because perhaps it's a very ambitious project to start writing when you're 19, you know. And then I guess secondly, I don't know if it's necessarily dopamine hits, but I just started getting all these ideas, and I honestly, I really enjoy it. Like, it has become, honestly, potentially my only hobby. I had to do things like, I'm just going to show you, I have bought this steel mace. I have a giant steel mace in my room. And then, like, this is my other hobby at the moment, where I'm like, okay, you're going to the gym, you're going to wave this mace around in the yard, you're going to go for walks and listen to audiobook. Like, I have to be like, okay, you're leaving the house, because if it's not writing, then it is social media, or it's writing emails, or it's like trying to figure out what potential projects you're doing in the future, or it's I'm packaging up all this pre-order art and sending it out to my patrons, like from Patreon, or you know, it's like all this stuff. I don't know.
It might can become just all-consuming.
Yeah,
you're like
yeah.
having to be and disciplined about having hobbies.
Exactly, because I genuinely really love it. But
yeah, how have you found managing your energy?
Energy. I think I've always found it difficult to switch off. And actually taking breaks and not being productive for periods of time has actually always been a challenge for me.
Yeah.
Not because I'm not tired, but because of the all-consuming guilt that comes along with actually taking care of yourself.
Yeah.
So it is a form of discipline as well, which I guess I find writing, you have to discipline yourself to write, because you can't just wait for the mood to take you, because it so rarely comes at opportune moments. And disciplining yourself to also rest has to become part of that routine, because if you are going to be writing for long periods of time, like there's so often that people just will write poorly, as in they write at awkward angles or for too long or with the wrong equipment, and then they just injure their bodies,
Their literal bodies get hurt.
Rather than the not only just the fatigue of trying to manage writing a book on top of everything else. So it is down to discipline.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, you don't often think of like authors literally hurting their bodies, but because it is
carpal tunnels. Really.
I was going to ask, do you have a word goal, or do you have a certain number of time you want to spend on your days off, and is it different from your days off, obviously, and from your regular work to the days when you are working?
I guess when I'm working, I'm a bit more free or flexible with my afternoons. Like some nights I'm like, you're not writing your personal projects tonight, and that's fine. You're going to play video games, you're going to go to the gym, or I mean, oftentimes I try to do what you did, which was, you know, you write a minimum of 500 words a day when you were doing that. On my days off, it's more chapter-based than words. Sometimes it's just because they're such, fantasy books usually have such long chapters, so it can be like 5,000 words. Then sometimes it really is, I'm going to write one chapter for this book and then maybe one chapter of my personal project. When I was writing the novella, I just finished Reborn, as in like the edits were done. So I was like, you literally cannot touch it anymore. And it was like, I don't want to start writing book three of my contracted work, so I'm going to have a little palate cleanser. And that was like, I wrote that like the end of March and April. So like five weeks.
Incredible.
I had so much fun with it, but I was like, I'm going to the state library and I'm making it like a routine. So I'm going to go in, work for as long as I can stand, you know, and then I'm going to go home. So there was more of a routine to that. But again, there's never like a goal. That was more like, you have to finish this before you start
and something else. Yeah, so you're like using books to help you finish books. You're like, if you want to do this next book, then you have to finish this book.
The ideas come and they're like, carrots on a stick. And you're like, ooh, fancy.
Yeah, I like it. You're like using the art to make art.
Well, I think that's why it's so hard for unpublished authors to finish projects, because we don't have things that are spurring us on. Like, it's just an unlimited amount of time. So it's just like, it's good to have. That's why I think I have to artificially impose structure and deadlines onto myself. Otherwise, it's just keeps going. Just keeps going. And it's like, if you give someone a certain amount of time to write a book and they have to write a book in that time, they'll probably manage it. Well, unless they're Pat Rothfuss or George R. R. Martin.
Yeah, interesting. I would love to talk about submissions, if you don't mind.
Yes, let's
kind of have a discussion about this process. So what was it like for you this year? What were you submitting? How did it feel? What kind of a roller coaster did you go on?
Because I think a lot of us think once you've got your first book deal, then like, that's it, you're done with submissions.
I wish. No, I guess for me as well, it's I am with a small press, and there are so many small presses. Like, I think when we think publishing, we think now the big four really is what it is, but there are so many, and so many smaller imprints as well under those big publishing houses, depending on the genre of what you're writing in. So I went on submission with my novella, currently titled Volatile Memory, which is a sci-fi novella about a trans woman scavenger finding a high-tech mask with the consciousness of a dead woman inside it, and it's from the point of view of that dead woman in the mask. Which is very fun.
A very simple story.
Yeah, not at all complex. I think like I can boil it down to space lesbians do a revenge, which is always a fun time.
Love a revenge story.
Incredible.
Love it. Yeah.
Also like the sentence space lesbians.
Not just regular lesbians, they're space lesbians.
They're in space. Don't forget it. So this is actually the first project that I've been on actual submission for, because it was a roundabout way with my current publisher, Blind Eye Books, where I kind of already had the deal before I got my agent, and it was like a really odd way of doing it. So I have been in the query trenches, but I was airlifted out of there before I landed an agent. So this is the first project actually being on submission, and it's daunting. I guess what happens is, first of all, with your agent, I mean, it's kind of impossible now to submit without an agent or go in an actual submission round without an agent. There are occasionally houses that will have open submission periods, but I suppose that's a bit different, because when you're going on submission, there's actually like lists of imprints and editors that are curated for you, basically. So when I went on submission, my agent had to think basically about every contact that she knew, and then was like, okay, in round one, these are the editors that I want to hit. And we're deliberately targeting specific editors from imprints. And then you have a second round and potentially a third round, aka you're going to get a whole lot of rejection again in this round. My rejections were quite nice, and I did get a few, and have been considered by publishers. So, I mean, some of them are, I love the story, but we simply don't do novellas. And there are so many places that don't do novellas. So it's not just the quality of the work, it's also the word count. And something as simple as paper and word count right now are actually limiting my third book, And Reborn, were limited by word count, because paper's so expensive right now that publishers can't afford to spend or to take that risk on a project. So once you've done the submission rounds, then you wait. And honestly, a lot of it is waiting, because you just gotta wait for these editors to read the books.
What timelines are we talking here?
Well, I mean, I have friends who've been on submissions for close to a year.
Yeah.
Because it really can be that long, especially with adult, like long form works.
Yeah.
Mine, I mean, novellas was like 35,000 words. So it's a lot easier, a lot quicker to get through.
Yeah, great.
It was still a month before I heard anything, including my first rejection.
Yeah, so, interesting.
Wow, so it's not that much quicker than if you're just cold querying agents.
I have questions about what they're up to. I do have questions. Like, I wanna understand what they do on a day-to-day basis sometimes.
Publishing is just, it's so slow. Publishing is incredibly slow.
And is it, and you, once... are you sending out the email still and saying, I have an agent, or is your agent sending the emails out for you?
No, my agent does it all. Right. So, and then I get it all filtered back to me, right?
Yeah,
so
nicely.
She offers to me, like, would you like everything that I hear to be sent to you? Okay, do you want the unfiltered feedback? And mm-hmm. I have had friends whose feedback from editors has been brutal, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's been like, no, this is trash, basically. And you're like, okay, wow. Thank you very much for your time. It, you know, it can be that brutal, but I was lucky and got really lovely rejections. And once you do find someone interested, it becomes an, you know, it's the editor, it's not even the publishing house at that point. You've just got sort of like your man on the inside kind of connection. and then it's us against the world.
Because they're trying to make it, then they have to make the case, right, to the publishing house, like, this is financially viable, or this is, and the business people put on their glasses and they check their spreadsheets and stuff, right?
Yeah, so this is the acquisitions meeting. So myself and also an agent sibling of mine have gone through similar things where an editor who's interested will pull you into sort of like a vibe check call, which my current publisher was like, that's so weird, like that never happens. And I'm like, well, apparently it's happening. It's happening now where it's literally a vibe check to see if you're on the same wavelength about where to take the project or how they could market it. Because, you know, if they're like, I was kind of thinking this, and you're like, oh no, it's far too serious for that, or, you know, oh, you know, it's a comedy, I don't think you understand the vision, you know, so you can kind of align there. And then there's more waiting, and then the editor will decide if they take it to acquisitions. And then at acquisitions, it's marketing, it's the top dogs, you're all in a big meeting, and
then you've included
effectively. Well, no, I've not been. You're not in.
Is the agent at an acquisitions meeting?
I have no idea.
No,
it's just them.
Completely an internal.
It's completely internal. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know how to put this without. In acquisition meeting as well, I mean, the editor and my agent, like, you can discuss kind of what the strategy is going to be, and part of a strategy in an acquisition meeting can be pitching the author as a brand.
Yes.
As in, we're not just selling this book.
We're selling this writer.
Yes. And here are all the reasons why, aka his social media following. Like, I have been asked to, can you please tell me your follow account, but also because I do playlists on TikTok where you can put videos into playlists. What's the total view count number and like count? So interactions for these things, which I will add that TikTok does not do this for you automatically. You have to sit there and manually count everything. Yeah. But then that gets sent off as like a list.
Wow.
And then I mean, I've had an agent sibling who the day after the acquisitions meeting was given a preempt offer. And then I've also heard of, offers taking over a month from the acquisitions meeting.
Wow. God, that would fucking suck.
Yeah, it would. and then you get something called a deal memo, which is basically a rundown of what will be in the contract. And there's a lot of jargon, but it'll tell you what imprints they're going for, what the advance is, how they're going to pay that out, whether it's I mean, it's never a lump sum now, it's always like a minimum of three, so like on signing, on the submission of your work or your edits, and then on publication.
Interesting.
And then things like territories, scheduling, what their royalty offers are,
it's huge.
Kind of
That is so, I'm so glad that we have you to talk, you know, through this, because it's so interesting and it's not spoken about. You really have to go through the process. You know, the authors are coming up completely blind when they have to move through this process because no one tells you what happens.
Yeah, no. Yeah. It can be quite a scary and terrifying thing. I think maybe sometimes, and I don't want to accuse the publishing industry of this, but like it maybe is almost deliberately opaque because then they can keep a little bit of the power for themselves as well.
For sure. And that's why it's just impossible to navigate without an agent now.
Yes.
And why you really want an agent, because they can also negotiate these things for you. Because I mean, getting a deal member from a big house, you're going to be like, fuck yes, I'll take whatever.
Of course. I'll take whatever. Yeah.
And they're going to be like, no, calm down. Okay, yeah. Let's think. Can we get you more of an advance? Okay, let's look at these royalties. Can we up the royalties a bit? Can we retain some of these rights for you, like foreign rights or film rights or, I don't know, game or graphic novel rights? Can we keep some of these? Potentially we can sell them ourselves, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you just wouldn't think about that. But they're so important.
You just grab it, yeah. Yeah.
For sure.
amazing. That was so fascinating. Yeah, so fascinating.
So illuminating, yeah.
Is there anything else in your mind, Casey?
There is something I'd like to talk about.
Oh my God, please.
I've just thought about it, actually. I don't know if you know, but TikTok is actually doing their own publishing house.
What?
Have you heard of this? No. You haven't heard of Bindery? That's... Okay, so there is something called Bindery, which is TikTok's, how do I even explain it? It is kind of a publishing house, but it's also a membership-based thing. And there are people called Taste Makers, which are basically famous TikTokers who have their own imprints, and then they get submissions and can effectively, members can be involved and can vote on things.
So interesting.
This is a disturbance in the publishing world.
Yes, exactly. So it is very interesting. I have heard something that like some contracts are vastly different depending on where you are in your publishing journey. So if you are, this is your first work, then they perhaps are a bit more controlling with the rights that they want, or every thought that comes out of your brain must go through us first. but then it is interesting, right? Because it kind of combines a almost self-publishing thing, but potentially there's also involvement from audiences or potential buyers. So we're not too sure. I've actually asked my agent and we've sort of just applied for a package which is sent out, which will describe more.
Oh, I want more information. That's super interesting.
And is this super recent? Like when did they announce this, do you know?
Sometime this year, I believe.
How have I missed
this? Let me see, what did actually she did send the brochure. Okay, so we got call. So they Bindery offers a new publishing pathway for authors. It's a traditional publisher. They offer advances, follow a high quality editorial and design process, and represent our titles into trade channels with Ingram and Two Rivers Distribution. But it's also not a traditional publisher because our acquisitions model is decentralized with imprints led by book tastemakers who have massive online audiences full of readers who love their taste in books. So we built a membership platform for these book tastemakers to deepen their community with their biggest fans, where members can see and participate in behind the scenes content about the publishing process. Engaging super readers in the creative process seeds a feeling of investment in the book's success and fuels buzz at launch. And the revenue model includes subscription from the membership platform, which changes the economics of publishing dramatically so that we can all, apparently they say they can offer authors over 2x industry standard per book royalties. So
interesting.
It's a similar submission process because you still have to go through an agent and submit to them. So it's not just, I mean, I'm sure there are indie works involved where these tastemakers can reach out.
Yeah. Wow,
then
that's
they
fucking
have a
interesting.
List of imprints. Yeah. And they've got like a list of the imprints with sort of like the comparison titles of what each person's interested in. And so you can think about who you submit to. But it would be interesting because I was talking to my agent about what would that look like. And I wonder if it would be more worth someone's while to create a book with almost that in mind. Do you know what I mean? Where like I'm going to be submitting to Bindery, especially if there is audience involvement. I mean, how married to the project do you want to be? I'm not sure really if an audience is like, I'd love the cover to look like XYZ, you know?
Yes.
I mean, not that even in TradPub, you don't get much say on covers anyway.
Exactly.
So it's quite in line, but.
Especially if you follow a book talker you like and you happen to like their taste and you're like, well, I could write a book for them. Like, why not? It's like that's not something it's not like we all follow traditional publishing editors at big publishing houses and know what they're gonna want. Like,
no, exactly.
It's really lifting the veil from a certain part of the industry.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I'm so excited by that. I'm so excited by all of these like disturbances and the ways that we get to decentralize our books.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
Yeah. What do you think? Because I feel like it is a time of change in the industry, right? Like it's things are really getting.
I hope so.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at the same time, it's a time of consolidation for the big publishing houses as well. So it's like, I feel like it's coming from both ends.
Yeah. I mean, it's super interesting. And we're literally writers sitting right in the middle of it, navigating it all and trying to figure out what the fuck to do with it.
Yeah.
I think there's value in both things. Like I really do like the idea of the autonomy and creative freedom of independent publishing, even if that means you're now a business runner, right? Because it's so much more than just writing. But at the same time, even in TradPub, you have to market yourself anyway.
Yes,
you have to
of
do
course.
All these things. So it is very similar. But I guess some people also prefer that there is a lot of prestige behind traditional publishing or the idea of traditional publishing. So that's always attractive to some people. And in general, I mean, having bigger editors or more people to help as well. So
yeah, definitely.
I think there's value in both things. I think hybrid is a fun.
I mean, Amy and I think I've had a lot of discussions about this lately that we want
to... Guys, I have to pee so badly.
You have to pee? I'm going to pause it. Okay, we're back and we have no idea. We've been talking offline for 10 minutes now, so I have no idea what we're talking about before. But we're going to change topic anyway. I'm sure it was very interesting whatever we were talking about.
I'm sorry, guys. I really, really had to pee.
While Amy was peeing, Seth brought up, and actually after Amy was peeing as well, Seth brought up an interesting point about, sorry, I had to get the timeline right there, about AI in book contracts. And you were talking about, Seth, that your agent is really big on making sure that publishing houses aren't allowed to train
the
algorithms on any work from their clients. So can you talk about...
The agency as a whole is very anti... AI language. Like there is actually AI clause in general that she wants to put in as per the Authors Guild. So the Authors Guild actually has generated AI training prohibition clause, as well as like a cover design clause, audiobook clause. Like you're not allowed to use any AI voices, you're not allowed to use AI generated art, and you're not allowed to train, which is obviously a big concern for creatives. And there are big four, I mean, there are a lot of houses like Small Press that don't have a consolidated language yet to put in their contracts, but it's definitely something that I think people should be getting their agents.
Well, I mean, authors should know, you know, authors should know that they can get
aware.
Protection. Yeah.
I mean, it's something that like if that had been in contracts 10 years ago before we knew about it, obviously how could it have been? It would have saved a lot of trouble, right? And there is a class action suit at the moment, isn't it? Between authors to against publishing houses about
because there are huge databases of work. I mean, any pirated book basically is being pulled in. So it's so difficult to be out of it when there's no law.
Which is fucked up. It's crazy that crazy that you're allowed to just do it. Like it is crazy.
So if you can get any like legitimate legal protection in your contract, then that's at least something.
I wonder what happens when you self-pub. What your
no idea. As Seth was saying, like if it's pirated, which a lot of books with any kind of following would probably get pirated, then it's just going to go into this black box probably.
Jesus.
I mean, there was that guy, what was his name? He was called out on Twitter maybe a month ago because he posted this link to what he thought was his super cool database of where he trained his AI from. And every author I knew was like, my debut novel's on here, all my novels are on here.
Oh
And
my
like, how
God.
dare you? How
It's
dare
fucked
you
up.
take my work, my years of my life, and try to train a program that in any way, shape, or form can emulate the most
So
human part of
fucking
us?
fucked up.
I once went on ChatGPT and I asked them, and I was like, ChatGPT, what do you have a list of the books that you've been trained on? And ChatGPT, it's the only time I've ever seen ChatGPT be like, oh, you know, what were we talking about?
Because the thing is, artificial intelligence is neither artificial nor intelligent. It is trained with the bias of its programmer in mind, which is why, I mean, not to get too political, but you can type in something like, do Palestinians deserve the right to live? And it will give you a very wishy-washy answer. And if you write the same thing about Israelis, it will say, yes, of course. I don't know what you're talking about,
Yeah, it's
right?
interesting.
Because it's not at all artificial. Oh, sorry, got a little heated there, but
The whole body language changed. But that is something
like,
like we have to be talking about.
yeah, as people think that it's going to be able to, like, AI is going to be able to produce some really amazing, unbiased, like, perfect
On.
explanations of things and prose and stuff, and it all it can do is repeat the data sets it's trained on and
With a bias.
and
And predict.
predict what is most likely to
Yes.
be following the next, like the previous word. And so, I mean, that's also why ChatGPT will falsely generate sources. Several people have been called out, like, can you give me a article on XYZ? And it will generate a fake URL that leads absolutely nowhere or to something completely different. You can do anything as well. Like, I went on there and I asked about some Greek myth that didn't exist or whatever. And it said, yes, of course, the story of Zeus
Oh
and the cat. Yes, everyone knows Zeus and the cat, you know, and it will sort of generate a fake story. And it's like, what are you talking about? And you can be like, that doesn't exist. Oh yes, no, you're right, it doesn't exist. And you can second guess even the truth, like 2 + 2 = 4, and then undermine it, and it will agree with you because that's the way it's programmed. It's like almost like a customer service thing. Like the
And
customer's always
if you
right.
ask the companies behind these tools, they'll be like, oh, you know, it's just a, you know, it's something that we're working on. We're working on it. It'll get better. But I don't think there's any evidence that it will get better. Like that it will be some kind of more ethical, less biased, like less, I don't know. It's just like, and also they can only ever do it with by stealing other people's words and stealing other people's
Yeah.
art.
And especially when the data set becomes corrupted with AI generated material, then it starts
Yes.
generating more and more nonsense, which we see in art, the art now, that's
Yes.
being pulled from AI generated art, and then it becomes less and less realistic. And it's just, oh, it's so frustrating.
Yeah, something I don't understand about people who about the idea that maybe AI will be able to write books in the future that will, you know, be bestsellers and that people will love, and then that'll replace all authors is that, and this could just be me being completely ignorant, but then there's still going to have to be an editor who then like basically gets submitted to by the AI and has to assess those books and be like, is this book actually okay? Like, because it's going to produce so much crap and so much stuff that maybe that like isn't. And also, I just think that you're still going to be presented with this with a similar problem where there's just going to be even more slush pile essentially, and then
Slush,
people so much
yeah,
slush, and then
which
that's
happened to Clarksworld, the magazine, and they actually had to close for a hot minute there because they just got so much AI generated crap. It was like, what are you people doing? I think the sad thing, though, is that we are all still working these menial jobs, and we're still slaves to capitalism. And you take art from us? That's what you take from us? Like, that's
I know.
stuff. It's like
what we need.
go after the lawyers and the accountants, please. Like, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, or jobs that you really do not need people to do it. And I don't know. It really frustrates me.
Of course,
It's so
I'm
sad.
it is. It's so
And yeah,
heartbreaking.
you're right. I haven't ever thought about that, but like, why do they have to use us as the initial use case? It's like, do something else, please.
Because
They're
I
always
think,
trying to take power away from artists because
and we're
we're
easy
change
targets.
makers.
We don't have power.
Feel of it as well. Like it, so many people went with the AI art argument comes down to, oh, but I don't have the time, or I wasn't gifted with this God-given skill. And it's like, it's not an innate ability. We train, we work hours and hours and hours, and we suffer in order to become like this. But it, yeah.
Really
I
hard.
don't know.
We speak to so many creatives who this is like really deeply upsets them. For a lot of them, they feel like, what's the point?
Yeah.
And I do like to finish off any conversation about AI with an understanding that like you cannot let these systems stop you from creating art. Like that's what they want.
And I don't think it's not done. You know, we haven't lost the battle. The battle's still going.
We haven't even gotten into IP lawyership yet. Like, what happens when an IP lawyer gets involved? Like, none of this is actually regulated. I think that's the current issue.
Yeah.
But also, I think art kind of has to inherently be human. Whatever these things are outputting, by definition, cannot be art.
Art. I agree.
That's what I think. I'm like, that's not art. You know, because there's no soul behind it.
There's no vulnerability.
There's no actual meaning. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Seth Godin's definition of art, which is creating something with the intention to connect. And I just feel like that's a human thing that humans do. And
AI,
we don't get
literally
that
literally can't do that.
No. And so we have to sit with that knowledge and we have to know that we have to fight for our art, like just like we've always had to fight for our art. But to not stop because of this, because it's important that we keep going, even when the risk is there that we are going to be taken advantage of.
I feel like it's particularly bad for visual artists at the moment because there's just so much AI generated visual art, and I feel in a way lucky to be a writer because I think it's not as obvious, or it's not as easy for people to take advantage of writers as it is to take advantage of it obviously still happens, but I really feel like for visual artists I really have a heart for them, and I really hope that we can find a way to
protect them
and I feel like I'm hopeful that we will find a way to protect them, and especially if people are, you know, putting these clauses into contracts and if you know other creators are standing up for
with the
visual
actors
artists and for the actors as well, of course. And I know that they're trying for robust clauses in their contract against using their images in AI art movies and TV and film. And, you know, if we can all unite and if we can collectively make a stand, I think that there's a lot of hope.
Yeah, I agree. Mm. But these conversations need to be had.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Seth. Like, I feel like I could talk to you all day. I always feel incredibly, incredibly inspired to write, oh my god, after this conversation, and I
Name
love it.
We had an interview the other day with Caroline Calloway, who's a sort of, you know, famous hot mess from New York, and halfway through she was like, wait a minute, are you at Inspired to Write? And then it was like, you came on my podcast and you just said, didn't know. I mean, it was an amazing, like, on super on brand moment, but it was also just like, what?
Are you at Inspired to Write?
We talk about it all the time. I'll just stop and I'll just be like, wait a minute. Are you at Inspired to Write?
So good.
Do you want to say anything? Is there anything you want to promote before we go? Well, obviously we'll put all the links in the show notes. I haven't read Reborn yet, but I read Reforged and I absolutely loved it because you didn't give me an art copy of Reborn this time, so I will of course read it because I was such a huge fan of Reforged. I think you're, and I obviously, having known you from when you were a baby writer, absolutely love you as a writer, and I'm so impressed by everything you've done. You're a real inspiration to me personally.
Yeah, we love
That's
you, Seth.
Is there anything you'd like to promote before we sign off?
Reborn, of course. It's 2 days old.
She's
a little baby.
She's just
world.
A little baby.
And by the time this comes out, it won't even be a week by the time this episode comes out, probably.
Go get an
infant book. If you like fate, if you like empire, a crumbling empire, actually. If you like fated lovers and past lives and vain merchant lord and tall goths, then I highly recommend.
The last one really got me.
It's a pretty good pitch.
Oh, tall goths. I don't. Yeah, both brother and sister are tall goths. So
that's nice.
Involved. Yeah,
that's very nice.
Great.
Well, there you go.
You got it.
Please go out and support Seth. Buy Seth's books. And it was lovely to have you, Seth.
Thank
Always
you.
Lovely to have you. And hopefully
Thank
we can
so
do
much.
Round three in the future.
My God.
I would love that. Thank you so much for having me.
We'll do
me.
It when you hit the New York Times bestseller list.
Next year.
Yes, when?
Next year.
When?
Thank you, Seth.
Thank you, Seth.